You're listening to Bowl of Rice. This podcast is brought to you by the Office of Undergrad Research and Inquiry. In a few seconds, you will be hearing from undergraduate students here at Rice University conducting research or any type of creative work. We will also be exploring the Houston food scene, so stick around to find out what students are eating these days. My name is Brendan Wong, and I'm your host. And joining me today is a senior majoring in ecology and evolutionary biology from McMurtry College. Welcome, Kelsey.
Hi.
Hi, Kelsey. All right, so you're obviously here to talk about your research, but before that, let's talk about what you do outside of research. So what are you involved with outside of research?
I'm not as involved at McMurtry as I used to be, but I'm still a very proud member of our Powderpuff team.
Nice.
I'm an offensive lineman.
Uh-huh.
And I'm pretty involved with the Rice Players and a little bit more with the VADA department this semester.
Yeah.
So I like doing costume designs and also a little bit of writing.
Are you telling me that you had a play last week?
I may or may not have had a play.
Yeah, you
last
did.
Week.
So you do a lot of theater and you do Powderpuff. Amazing. All right. And so now let's talk about your research then. Let's dive right in. So what is your research focus?
Oh, yeah. My senior thesis is focused on the impacts of hyposalinity stress on the coral microbiome, or really the whole holobiont. So like the coral host animal and then also all of the microbes that coral hosts. So that includes like symbiotic algae that live inside their tissues and photosynthesize to help corals reach their energy requirements, and also bacteria that help cycle nutrients and protect the coral from pathogens. So what I want to find out is how hyposalinity, so reduced salinity that is usually associated with flooding and heavy rainfall on reefs, how that low salinity water encroaching on the corals causes like health responses.
Wow, I was just very blown away. You just said that so quickly. So first of all, you research corals.
I do research corals.
Which is incredibly fascinating. Do you research corals on campus?
I do. I work in Adrian Correa's lab under the guidance of Dr. Amanda Shore, who's a Rice Academy fellow here. And together, we take care of currently two species of coral that we have in aquariums here on campus.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
We have Parietes cylindrica and Montastia cavernosa.
Wow.
In case you cared.
I do care. So you're focusing your senior thesis on corals. Can you tell me a little bit more about what you're focusing on in terms of like the salinity aspect, I'm guessing?
Yeah. So in October, actually, we ran a 96 consecutive hour tank-based experiment.
Mm-hmm.
So around the clock, we monitored these corals while they were sitting in tanks, and we exposed them to a number of stressors. Dr. Shore had a couple stressors that she was focusing on, but I was focusing on hyposalinity stress, which meant that even though corals like to live in about 35 parts per thousand water, that's normal seawater, mm-hmm. I removed some of the salt water and replaced it with sterile fresh water over time, mm-hmm. dropping the salinity 3 parts per thousand every hour. So it took me about 5 hours of constantly cycling water to get the tanks down to 20 parts per thousand.
Yeah.
And corals don't like that. That's too close to freshwater for them. They're generally considered osmoconformers, which means that they like to regulate their tissues to be close to the water around them.
Yeah.
But if they're used to 35 parts per thousand and all of a sudden you're causing them to be 20 parts per thousand, it's instantly like not good for them.
Yeah. So why are we curious about salinity with the surrounding coral environment?
I'm curious about salinity and corals, particularly because here in Houston we experience lots of heavy rainfall and flooding.
Mm.
And when like heavy rainfall on oceans and then also on land that then translates to lots of floodwaters occurring, and also the regular flooding of the Mississippi River,
yeah.
means that like plumes of fresh water are getting out to coral reefs, because we do have coral reefs in the Gulf of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
We have the Flower Garden Banks National Marine Sanctuary, which is one of the healthiest reefs in the Caribbean, but it's experiencing this regular flooding, and I wanted to see how at least one of the impacts from this flooding is targeting corals.
Wow. First of all, I also didn't know that we have reefs like near Texas.
We have beautiful reefs in Texas. Yeah.
What? Mm-hmm. So do you ever get to go visit then?
I've been on a cruise once. So they're about a day's boat ride off the coast of Galveston.
Uh-huh.
And they're what, like 80 feet down? They're particularly deep for Caribbean reefs, which means they're a little bit colder.
Yeah.
But they do have really high coral cover and low prevalence of disease, which makes them unique for Caribbean reefs.
Yeah.
And I'm not a scientific diver, so I wasn't allowed in the water. But I was on the boat, like, so people would bring up coral samples, and then I would process them, like, put them in tubes and keep track of who was where in the fridge.
Yeah.
And got to see all the pictures that the divers took, and it was gorgeous. They saw, like, manta rays and, like, big fishes.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. So you talked about like the potential stressors and like how salinity is one of them. Is that what causes like corals to start bleaching or?
Maybe. It's kind of complicated. So bleaching, probably what you're thinking of is thermal bleaching, which is when corals under high temperature conditions, they get stressed and they lose their symbiotic algae or Cymbiodiniaceae. And that algae is what is in their tissue giving them their color and photosynthesizing. So when they lose the algae, their tissues become more transparent, and the bleaching is you can see through to their skeleton. So they look really pale.
Oh.
But the corals themselves aren't actually dead.
Yeah.
They're just really pale, and they have the possibility of reuptaking Cymbiodiniaceae, which would then regain their color and recover from bleaching. But there's also been experimental evidence and field evidence of low salinity bleaching. And we saw a little bit of that in our tanks because we also took PAM data to measure photosynthetic efficiency. Side, that's complicated. So we saw a little bit of paling in our tanks, but not enough that I would say it was bleaching, but it is possible.
So can you tell me a little bit about the relationship that you mentioned with corals and this algae? Like, what is a symbiotic relationship?
Oh, a symbiotic relationship is when two organisms live in... God, I want to say the word relationship. It's when they live interacting with one another and they both benefit. So the way corals and their symbiotic algae work is that the coral provides this like nice, stable host place to live in the water column where the algae has like a good potential to get lots of light, access to nutrients and protection from like predation and other fish happening. And then the coral benefits because the algae photosynthesizes, and that gives the coral close to 90% of its energy requirements.
Oh, wow. Going back to your senior thesis, so you were talking about you wanted to look at the salinity aspect of it. So what did you end up finding? Do you know?
It's in progress. So okay. I wanted to look at the reaction of the coral host, the reaction of the photosymbiont, and the reaction of bacterial species. I'm really most interested in bacterial species. But from what we saw so far, we've looked at host response and photosymbiont or algae response, and we're seeing that between the two species of coral that I looked at, so I looked at Orbicella faviolata, which is an endangered species in the Caribbean, and also Montastia cavernosa, which is a closely related other species of mountainous star coral. At least one of them is mountainous star coral. They're bouldering stony corals. They build reefs. A common stress response you see in corals is that they produce a lot of mucus. And we saw almost immediately after applying this hyposalinity stress that the Montastrias were producing tons of mucus. And the Orbicella didn't respond as severely, interestingly enough. And then as we kept the corals in these tanks, we kept them in for 96 hours. Starting around like 30 or 40 hours, we started to see that corals were experiencing tissue loss and mortality. So we had to prematurely remove some of our samples because we were worried they were going to foul our tanks.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting to see that like this chronic hyposalinity stress, like over a couple of days, was starting to cause death in the corals because there aren't any existing studies that really test like chronic hyposalinity stress.
And so you're talking about these bacterial communities that you're specifically interested in. Where does bacteria come in terms of these corals?
Yeah, I was going to say, we haven't talked about those at all yet. So bacteria are really important. So corals host a suite of microbes that provide various functions for them. And these include the symbiotic algae that we've talked about at length, also fungi, archaea, viruses even, and bacteria. And bacteria are most notable because they help cycle nutrients, like fixing nitrogen, carbon, sulfur, breaking down DMSP, and producing secondary metabolites, and also like filling entry niches to help protect the coral from pathogens.
Yeah.
And so these bacteria are really important for coral health, like notably because it helps the coral get the nutrients it needs and also protect against disease.
Yeah.
And the coral hosts like a whole community of a bunch of different bacteria that live in the mucus layer and like in the tissues and the skeleton.
Yeah.
And so I want to look at how if a coral under normal conditions has like a healthy community that's working for it, how when I introduce a stressor, that community changes.
Yeah.
And what we were expecting was a bloom of opportunistic pathogens or bacteria that usually exist on in the coral community at low abundances and are manageable. But when given the opportunity to do so, they will bloom in population and cause like disease or stress responses. So what we found... What we did was a culture-based analysis and a culture-independent analysis.
Yeah.
And so far, we have the culture-based analysis done, which was I poured hundreds of plates of different types of media and then spent hours streaking out mucus samples onto all of these plates and then incubating them for a couple of days and physically counting all of the individual colonies that formed on my plates. So I wanted to look at how if introducing the salinity stress altered the pathogen load of the corals.
Yeah.
So I like streaked the same mucus on both the marine agar plates and the TCBS media to see if the proportion of Vibrio, so the amount of things growing on the TCBS plates with respect to the MA plates, was changing, and if we were seeing an increase in Vibrios over time over stress.
Hmm. Wow, very scientific there. You were talking about when you changed the salinity, the corals produced mucus and you collected those mucus.
Yes.
And then you tried and sample it more to see what the composition of the mucus were.
Yeah, what the bacteria living in the mucus were.
Oh, wow. And so were you, so you talked about how you can also look at corals and also look at the algae. Did you also look at those aspects too, or you're again mostly focused on the bacteria?
We did aspect? Look at the algae a little bit. We used PAM fluorometry to measure the photosynthetic efficiency of the algae.
Yeah.
So basically what that means is we like shined a little light on it.
Yeah.
And then we wanted to see how well the algae were photosynthesizing, which then translates to how well are the algae working and being able to provide for these corals in terms of their energy requirements. And we found that at least the first couple of days under stress, we saw a decline in the ability of these algae to photosynthesize, which indicates that coral health is declining. Yeah. And then there's also a culture-independent process that we're undergoing right now, if you're interested.
Yes. So you talked about there too, right? There's one where you're culturing with media?
Yes.
And then the other cultured independently.
Yeah. Culture-independent means it's sequence-based. So that is a multi-step process where we used an airbrush to take all of the mucus and tissue off of the coral skeletons.
Yeah.
So now we have this like slurry of tissue and mucus from each coral sample. And then we extracted DNA from all of these slurry samples.
Yeah.
Which are, there are hundreds of.
Yeah.
And then we are going to send that DNA off for 16S high throughput sequencing, which means that we're going to send it off to Georgia Genomics and they're going to do something fancy. And identify the DNA sequences that are pulled from that whole sample. So it's like a community analysis.
Yeah.
And then when we get that data back, I'm going to go through it and make pie charts to like understand the relative abundances and community structure of like what bacteria are living in there, and then see if I can make meaningful comparisons between control conditions and stress conditions.
Very cool. All right. So you talked about how you're very interested in looking at salinity because the reefs around here experience a lot of heavy rainfall and like thunderstorms. I was curious, like, would there also be like other things that they bring that are like dirty sediments that like would affect corals?
Yes. Dr. Shore is actually also working on a project involving wastewater.
Oh.
So when flooding and terrestrial runoff brings like the kinds of bacteria that are in our sewage.
Like nasty stuff. Yeah.
Nasty stuff, yeah.
When you're doing this experiment, how realistic do you have to make these conditions to be? Like, do you also have to put in some nasty stuff into your sample? Or how do you get that like realistic comparison? Or are you going for a realistic comparison?
I would hope that we'd start combining stressors in the future.
Yeah.
But there's only so much time before I graduate.
No, stay forever.
I know, I wish I could. So right now, I'm just focusing on salinity.
So right now, you're focusing on salinity. Perfect. And so looking forward in terms of where you're going to bring, where this project and your senior thesis is going in the future, can you tell me a little bit about that aspect?
Yes, I'm really interested in how stressors and just other interactions that the coral may be experiencing with its environment affect the bacterial community structure.
Yeah.
And so I'm hoping to apply to grad school. We'll see how that goes.
You got this.
Yeah, so I'm interested in exploring other stressors. So not just salinity, but also maybe temperature stressor or hypoxia is a really understudied stressor that I'd be interested in looking at, which is also a relevant stressor for the flower garden banks.
Yeah. What is hypoxia?
Oh, hypoxia is low dissolved oxygen.
So it just means not a lot of oxygen in the water?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Wow. Mm-hmm. So what are some other stressors that can stress corals?
Oh, tons of things stress out corals. Yeah, they're really bad at surviving.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God, that's so either. Sad. Yeah, it's rough for corals out here.
Yeah. You know how you always see, like, the status of coral health, like, on, like, social media? I think corals are very easy to pinpoint in terms of, like, the earth is dying, corals are dying.
Yeah.
Like, it's really, it's kind of like a, it's very symbolic, I think, in terms of conservation.
The really big one is, I think, climate change and, like, rising temperatures and ocean acidification. People recognize that that's affecting corals because there's, like, tons of papers and research about it.
Right.
But then there's also, like, the cascading effects of those greater global processes. So we're seeing, like, increased incidence of severe weather. So we're seeing more stressors like hypoxia and hyposalinity, and then we're also seeing more like agricultural runoff, which may be nutrient pollution, or we're seeing algal encroachment. I read a paper very recently about how nutrient pollution and overfishing and combined with temperature increase algal encroachment on corals, and that causes like a huge problem for corals because then algae can outcompete the coral.
Oh gosh.
And then the corals are just, coral reefs are completely taken over by algae, and then they lose all the ecosystem functions that those corals are providing.
Algae?
Yes.
Wow. And just more generally about corals, what are some misconceptions that people have about coral reefs and corals do you think that people have?
I think not a lot of people know that corals are animals. Yes, corals are very amazing animals. They're colonial animals.
Uh-huh.
So the animal itself is a teeny tiny polyp that looks a lot like an anemone.
Yeah.
Or they're very closely related to anemones and jellyfish, like other cnidarians, because they have stinging cells.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's this tiny polyp that is like a mouth surrounded by tentacles. They have three tissues. They're really simple organisms. But they live in massive colonies of a bunch of little polyps connected together. And those polyps secrete a calcium carbonate skeleton, so they, like, lay down live rock. And you can, like, corals are almost like trees. You can, like, watch them grow. And it's almost like a geologic time scale or like a tree time.
Mm.
And so these animals build this live rock, so, and they look like the rock structures. Like, you're familiar with, like, the 3D structure of a reef. So a lot of people think, like, oh, it's just a rock, but really it's an animal that's creating that and an animal living there on the reef. So you can't just, like, touch a reef because it's a living thing. And then also because we have some sort of, like, understanding of corals photosynthesize. Well, it's not actually the coral animal that's photosynthesizing. It's its algal partner.
Yeah.
So it's this algae that's living in its tissues in a symbiotic relationship. So corals are really cool because they're animals, but they, like, do things like rocks, and they also kind of act like plants.
Yeah.
But they're animals.
Cool. Can you tell me a little bit about what, like, drew you to studying corals in the first place?
Well, I'm from South Florida.
Yeah.
So I've always loved the ocean and marine biology for a really long time. I thought I was going to study turtles.
Uh-huh.
And then after turtles, like, sharks were all the rage. And I was like, I'm going to be a chondrichthyologist because I was little and loved big words.
Uh-huh.
And then I went a little astray and in high school. And then really when I came to Rice, I thought that I wanted to be a biochemistry major.
Yeah.
And I was really gung-ho about it because I'm like, I love molecular work and I love using pipettes and, like, doing PCR and all that fancy stuff. But I just really wasn't enjoying the kinds of questions that I was asking.
Yeah.
Like, DNA and proteins are cool, but I don't know if they're what really gets me excited at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So then I was considering switching majors and ultimately did switch majors from biochemistry to ecology and evolutionary biology. And Adrian's lab seemed really cool, Adrian Correa. Her lab focuses on the microbial ecology and, like, viral ecology associated with coral reefs.
Yeah.
And so I was initially drawn because of that, like, interest of marine biology when I was little.
Yeah.
And also because I don't like bugs. And we do a lot of bug research here at Rice. And then I started working more, and I realized that she does a ton of molecular work. So lots of – I still get to pipette, and I still get to do all these molecular assays that I like, but I get to ask questions about ecology and, like, big-picture community stuff, which I find way more interesting.
Oh, wow. That's exactly what you're describing to me. Like, you're doing all these really detailed analysis, but at the same time, you're, like, looking at something as amazing as corals. Wow. That's amazing. So more broadly speaking then, if we're talking about super big picture, where do you plan on going from here?
Well, I gotta go somewhere because
yes,
Rice is gonna
be.
Make me leave. They're gonna make me graduate. Yeah, I'm not entirely sure what I want to do next. I am definitely considering applying to grad school.
Yeah.
But some days you really just want to work at a zoo, you know?
Of course, yeah. Actually, that's what I think about sometimes. I'm like, maybe I just want to work at a zoo.
I did apply for an internship at the Houston Zoo.
Oh, yeah? Wow.
Yeah.
So maybe you'll just be right around the corner. Do you still want to look into corals maybe or other marine species?
I do. With respect to applying to grad schools, I have been just looking at coral ecology labs to continue doing the sort of, like, bacterial community assay stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in terms of your senior thesis for eBio work?
By the spring semester, I will have gotten, I had mentioned sending off DNA samples for sequencing.
Right.
So by the spring semester, I will have gotten those sequences back, and that's when I'll be doing a lot of my analyzing and comparing structure kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then I'll be writing a really big paper. And
on salinity.
On salinity. And it is a graduation requirement that you present at RERS or some sort of comparable presentation.
Yeah. So you talked about how we have an aquarium at Rice.
We do.
So what's the situation right now with the corals?
Well, we have a setup where it's kind of like a set of shelves that you can put small 25-gallon tanks on.
Yeah.
And I say they're small. No, they're 25 liters.
And a liter. Gallons, liters?
A gallon is approximately 3-ish liters.
Mm.
Yeah, they're liters because we're scientists. And so we have a bunch of tanks that you can just like put on the shelves. We have two running right now. And one has Parietes cylindrica in it, which is a Pacific coral that we got from the Houston Zoo.
Yeah.
And then the other tank has fragments of Montastia cavernosa in it, which is one of our study corals that we just happened to have left over from our experiment.
Yeah.
We got them from the U.S. Virgin Islands. My mentor actually went and like dove and got them.
Oh, wow.
Under a permit.
Oh, and, okay. I was like, she just went and just got it.
Yeah. And since we're not actively doing any experiments with them right now, I just go take care of them. They have a nice little setup. They have heaters and like a little air bubbler.
Oh, wow.
They have little lights that like shine UV on them, like fancy basking lights that are all like hooked up in the system. We make our own seawater using Instant Ocean.
Wow.
So it's in this giant, very poorly designed reservoir because I'm very short. So it's really tall and I have to like stand on a chair with like a spoon on a stick and stir it. It's a lot.
Wow.
But we make lots of seawater and then I change the seawater out, do like a partial water change of the tank every 2 or 3 days, and then every 2 or 3 weeks I'll do a tank change because bacteria and biofilm start to accumulate on the tanks themselves.
Mm.
And then if anything starts growing on our corals, I like take a little toothbrush and give them little scrubby baths.
Amazing.
Yeah.
All right. And so for my final question for you, Kelsey, there's going to be a curveball question.
Oh my God, yes, the curveball question.
All right. So where in Houston did you have the best food?
My favorite food in Houston.
Maybe it's the Walk on Sunset.
Oh my God, I do love the Walk on Sunset. Okay. Like, God, if anyone from H&D listens, I love the Walk on Sunset. It's like, it's a very consistent vegetarian option.
Yes, it
and
is.
It's so good. Fried rice every day. I'm about it. There's some sort of tofu. Sometimes the egg rolls are vegetarian. Like, and I get out of work or class most days at like 1. So then I can go to the Walk on Sunset. No one's there. There's no line.
There's
I
no
get
line.
All the fried rice. It's amazing.
Oh my gosh. Maybe that's it. That's your answer.
Okay.
Or do you have another answer? Walk on Sunset and...
Are you actually going to say my answer about Walk on Sunset?
I know. I just said Walk on
Sunset. I do love the Walk on Sunset.
Okay,
you can tell everyone I said
yeah.
that. The Walk is so good. I like the truffle egg salad sandwich at local foods. I just think that I'm going to like be adventurous and try something new and like pick up the menu and pretend to read it when actually I know I'm going to get the egg salad sandwich every time.
Okay, I got to try that next time too. I exclusively get the salmon bagel too.
Oh, I'm a vegetarian, so
okay.
I'm limited.
But that definitely sounds delicious. All right, so today we talked so many things. We talked about corals, salinity, and we talked about walk and truffle egg sunset. Oh, truffle egg sunset. And the truffle
egg sunset.
And the truffle eggs and then local foods. Well, again, I just want to thank you so much for joining me today, Kelsey. And I'm very excited to go listen to your presentation spring semester. Woo!
Woo!
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Brandon.
Once again, thank you for listening. If you're interested in being on this podcast, feel free to reach out to me at my email account, bw19@rice.edu. That is bw19@rice.edu. All right, bye.